Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back for another As It Is program. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we have two interesting stories for you. The first is about new technology from the Apple Corporation. Then, civil rights in America, an important anniversary, the President of the United States, and a Hollywood movie are all involved. So, let's get started. Here is Ann Ball with more on the big news from Apple.
Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, showed off their newest device, the Apple Watch. Mr. Cook said it is the most personal device Apple has ever created. The Apple Watch is a miniature or very small computer a person wears on his or her wrist. There will be three models with straps to attach them to your wrist. An Apple Watch will be able to do many of the same things as an iPhone. It will show email, texts, news, health readings, and other information. These apps will be customized for the watch. It will be different than just seeing what is on your phone. Like a phone, you will be able to receive calls on your wrist. Mr. Cook smiled while describing this. "I've been wanting to do this since I was 5 years old," he said. "The day is finally here." Decades ago, a comic strip hero named Dick Tracy talked into his wristwatch, but until now, that has only been something possible in the future. The crown of the Apple Watch is what sets this Apple product apart from other companies' smartwatches. Like the touch screen on smartphones, the crown controls what you can do. By turning the crown on an Apple Watch, you can zoom in and out to look at a map, for example. The watches will be available in stores in late April. They will be sold at different prices, beginning at $349. Mr. Cook called the high-end model, the one made of 18-karat gold, jaw-dropping beautiful. Its price tag will be thousands of dollars. The biggest surprise to me was that the price range goes up to $10,000 for the Apple Edition watch, writes tech blogger Carolyn Nickender Moore of The Wonder of Tech. That price is quite steep for technology that may be obsolete in a year. Apple hopes to excite consumers so they will want to buy and wear computers on their bodies. The first smartwatches from Samsung, Sony, and LG have not been selling well. Only 5 million smartwatches were sold last year, according to Strategy Analytics. Another wearable computer, Google Glass Eyewear, is no longer on the market. Critics say one problem with Apple Watch is that you need an iPhone on your body or nearby to make this watch fully functional. Like a phone, it will also need to be charged each night. It remains to be seen whether people really want to carry both a smartphone and a smart watch. Apple has overcome skeptics before. Both computer tablets and smartphones were not popular until Apple released the iPad and iPhones. The announcement today comes after last week's news that Apple will replace AT&T on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The Dow Jones Index includes the top 30 companies representing the U.S. economy and markets. I'm Ann Ball.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. This month, President Barack Obama went to Selma, Alabama, to mark the 50th anniversary of a day known as Bloody Sunday. On March 7, 1965, police officers brutally attacked peaceful demonstrators there. The protesters were part of a campaign to get voting rights for African Americans. As we hear from Jonathan Evans, the incident in Selma led to passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The act removed legal barriers that prevented many African Americans from voting.
The 2014 Hollywood film Selma is about the events of 50 years ago. The movie is a sign of renewed interest in the American civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. For years, parts of the southern United States had trouble dealing with the past. Now, many southern communities are coming to terms with their history. They have taken steps to recognize what happened with hopes of appealing to visitors from across the country and from overseas. Many towns, including Selma, are adding historical markers, building museums, and fixing up churches that were part of the civil rights movement. The images of police beating back peaceful voting rights protesters brought the world's attention to Selma, Alabama, in March of 1965. Days after Bloody Sunday, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. led thousands in a historic voting rights march. Lee Sintel directs Alabama's tourism department. He says he hopes that tourists can learn more about the civil rights struggles and the people who were a part of the movement.
Our job is to make sure that people learn about the story beyond just the fact that Martin Luther King made a lot of great speeches, because there were ordinary people who had a lot to lose, whether their jobs or their lives, and they demonstrated to make change come to the South and the country and the world.
Fred Gray is a civil rights lawyer. He recently spoke to tourists about the events of 50 years ago.
After they were beaten back on Bloody Sunday, they called me and I went over that same night.
Fred Gray and his wife founded a small museum in Tuskegee, Alabama, in 1997. Now, it is one of several organizations in Alabama that provide people a look into the fight against racial discrimination. Mr. Gray says he hopes the state will create and maintain more civil rights landmarks.
The state of Alabama, and particularly the Department of Tourism, now recognize the fact that civil rights is an engine for economic growth and development. They see that people are interested and that we need to preserve that history. And by preserving it and by people coming in, it generates tourism.
William Bell is the mayor of the city of Birmingham, Alabama. He says over 200,000 people visit civil rights attractions in the city each year.
I think by looking at our civil rights history and attracting people to come in and see not only the way we were, but the way we are and the way we want to be, will give us the financial support to really make sure that our cities grow and prosper.
Melissa Gray brought her family to Selma from Georgia. She says it's important for people to understand history to avoid repeating history.
Well, I think if we don't understand our history, we may definitely repeat our history. And it's so important for our children who don't have to deal with the struggles that my predecessors and siblings and my parents had to deal with.
In Selma, residents are embracing this increase in civil rights tourism. They hope it will improve the struggling economy, provide more jobs, and help the city. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The administration of President Barack Obama is seeking to make new trade deals. Among these is the Trans-Pacific Partnership with 11 Pacific nations. Another is a trade agreement with Europe. But getting trading partners to sign the deals and the U.S. Congress to approve them will require settling many differences. One of those issues is how nations manage their currency. Protesters from U.S. trade unions and other free trade skeptics say some nations manipulate the value of their currencies. This can give their exports an unfair price advantage on world markets. And that, the critics say, hurts American workers. Democratic Party Senator Chuck Schumer says the U.S. must do more to protect American workers.
We should shrug our shoulders. And it's estimated that millions of jobs have gone away.
Exporting countries gain when the exchange value of their currency is low. Carnegie Mellon University economics professor Lee Brandstetter says this can have the same effect as providing financial support or protection to a nation's exporters. He spoke via Skype.
It's making their goods artificially cheap, our goods artificially expensive. It's as if they were subsidizing their exports and applying tariffs to our imports.
Mr. Brandstetter says nations can change the value of their own currencies by using their money to buy U.S. currency and government securities. More demand for U.S. money makes it more costly. Less demand for a nation's currency makes it less costly. Some members of Congress are concerned that the issue of unfairly low currency values will hurt manufacturing jobs. They say new trade deals must stop currency manipulation. But Mr. Brandstetter says such rules also could affect U.S. economic policies, such as efforts to keep interest rates low. The Trans-Pacific Partnership now is almost completed. Some experts say adding currency manipulation provisions now could stop the agreement. Under Secretary of State Catherine Novelli says failing to reach a deal could hurt U.S. workers.
If we don't get the deal done, rules can be put in place that are not going to be fair, and the bar can be set very low, and that could really impede our ability to export the things that our workers and our farmers are producing.
A separate agreement called Trade Promotion Authority is being discussed in Congress. Under TPA, Congress can accept or reject trade agreements, but cannot amend or delay them. Republican Party Senator Orrin Hatch is the head of the committee that deals with trade issues. He says the Republican majority in Congress makes it more likely that the deals will win approval. And that's the VOA Learning English Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell the story of that war.
Unlike other presidents of the late 1800s, William McKinley spent much of his presidency dealing with foreign policy. The most serious problem involved Spain. Spain ruled Cuba at that time. Cuban rebels had started a fight for independence. The Spanish government promised the Cuban people equal rights and self-rule, but in the future. The rebels did not want to wait. President McKinley felt Spain should be left alone to honor its promises. He also felt responsible for protecting the lives and property of Americans in Cuba. When riots broke out in Havana, he ordered the battleship Maine to sail there. One night in early 1898, a powerful explosion sank the Maine. More than 250 American sailors died. There was some evidence the explosion was caused by an accident in the ship's fuel tanks. But many Americans blamed Spain. They demanded war to free Cuba and make it independent.
President McKinley had a difficult decision to make. He did not want war. As he told a friend, "I fought in our Civil War. I saw the dead piled up. I do not want to see that again." But McKinley also knew many Americans wanted war. If he refused to fight Spain, his Republican Party could lose popular support. So he did not ask Congress for a declaration of war right away. He sent a message to the Spanish government instead. McKinley demanded an immediate ceasefire in Cuba. He also offered his help in ending the revolt. By the time Spain agreed to the demands, McKinley had made his decision. He asked Congress for permission to use military force to bring peace to Cuba. Congress agreed. It also demanded that Spain withdraw from Cuba and give up all claims to the island. The president signed the congressional resolution. The Spanish government immediately broke relations. On April 25, 1898, the United States declared war on Spain.
The American Navy was ready to fight. It was three times bigger than the Spanish Navy. It also was better trained. A shipbuilding program begun 15 years earlier had made the American Navy one of the strongest in the world. Its ships were made of steel and carried powerful guns. Part of the American Navy at that time was based in Hong Kong. The rest was based on the Atlantic coast of the United States. Admiral George Dewey commanded the Pacific Fleet. Dewey had received a message from the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Theodore Roosevelt. If war broke out, it said, he was to attack the Spanish naval force in the Philippines. The Spanish force was commanded by Admiral Patricio Montojo.
The American fleet arrived in Manila Bay on May 1st. It sailed toward the line of Spanish ships. The Spanish fired first. The shells missed. When the two naval forces were 5,000 meters apart, Admiral Dewey ordered the Americans to fire. After 3 hours, Admiral Montojo surrendered. Most of his ships were sunk. 400 of his men were dead or wounded. American land forces arrived several weeks later. They captured Manila, giving the United States control of the Philippines.
Dewey was suddenly a hero. Songs and poems were written about him. Congress gave him special honors. A spirit of victory spread across the nation. People called for an immediate invasion of Cuba. Unlike the Navy, America's army was not ready to fight. When war was declared, the army had only about 25,000 men. Within a few months, however, it had more than 200,000. The soldiers trained at camps in the southern United States. One of the largest camps was in Florida. Cuba is just 150 kilometers off the coast of Florida.
2 weeks after the Spanish-American War began, the Army sent a small force to Cuba. The force was ordered to inspect the north coast of Cuba and to take supplies to Cuban rebels. That invasion failed, but the second one succeeded. 400 American soldiers landed with guns, bullets, and supplies for the rebels. Next, the Army planned to send 25,000 men to Cuba. Their goal was the port of Santiago on the south coast. American ships had trapped a Spanish naval force there earlier. One of the commanders of the big American invasion force was Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt had resigned as Assistant Secretary of the Navy when the war started. He organized a group of horse soldiers. Most of the men were cowboys from America's Southwest. They could ride and shoot well. Some were rich young men from New York who simply shared Roosevelt's love of excitement. The group became known as Roosevelt's Rough Riders.
As the Americans landed near Santiago, Spanish forces withdrew to positions outside the city. The strongest force was at San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers used smokeless gunpowder. This made their artillery hard to find. The Americans did not have the smokeless powder, but they had Gatling machine guns, which poured a stream of bullets at the enemy. When the machine guns opened fire, American soldiers began moving up San Juan Hill. Several American reporters watched. Later, one of them wrote this report. "I have seen many pictures of the charge on San Juan Hill, but none seem to show it as I remember it. In the pictures, the men are running up the hill quickly in straight lines. There seem to be so many men that no enemy could stand against them." "In fact," said the reporter, "there were not many men, and they moved up the hill slowly, in a close group, not in a straight line. It seemed as if someone had made a terrible mistake. One wanted to call to these few soldiers to come back.
The American soldiers were not called back. They reached the top of San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers fled. "All we have to do," an American officer said, "is hold on to the hill, and Santiago will be ours." American Commander General William Shafter sent a message to Spanish Commander General José Toral. Shafter demanded Toral's surrender. While he waited for an answer, the Spanish naval force tried to break out of Santiago Harbor. The attempt failed, and the Americans took control of the port. The loss destroyed any hope that Spain could win the war. There was now no way it could send more soldiers and supplies to Cuba. General Toral agreed to a short ceasefire so women and children could leave Santiago. But he rejected General Shafter's demand of unconditional surrender. American artillery then attacked Santiago. General Toral defended the city as best he could. Finally, on July 17th, he surrendered. The United States promised to send all his soldiers back to Spain.
In the next few weeks, American forces occupied Puerto Rico and the Philippine capital of Manila. America's war with Spain was over. It had lasted just 10 weeks. The next step was to negotiate terms of a peace treaty. The negotiations would be held in Paris. The victorious United States demanded independence for Cuba. It demanded control over Puerto Rico and Guam, and it demanded the right to occupy Manila. The two sides agreed quickly on the terms concerning Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam, but they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. Spain rejected the American demand for control. It did not want to give up this important colony. Negotiations on this point of the peace treaty lasted for days. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.